Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, we'll look back at the weekend that was in international football. Victory for England over Switzerland with some new faces included. Gareth Bale is an old face and he keeps that form going. But is he the greatest British player of the last 40 years? We'll also talk about his comments on responsible journalism. Should there be a UK team at the Olympics? We'll have the latest on the Chelsea bidders. We'll also talk Roberto Mancini. This is The Game. Hello, welcome back to the Game Podcast. I'm Hugh Wizencroft alongside Tom Roddy, Tom Clark and the one and only Tony Cascarino. Welcome, gentlemen. Loads for us to discuss. We're going to start with events at Wembley where England beat Switzerland 2-1. It was a friendly match, of course, and they had to come from behind thanks to goals from Luke Shaw and a Harry Kane penalty as well. Wasn't exactly vintage England, you got to say. Switzerland gifted them the goals in many ways, but it was far from a vintage starting 11 for England either. Very inexperienced. Experienced. You saw debuts for Kyle Walker-Peters, Mark Gerhey and Tyrick Mitchell, and the likes of Conor Gallagher and Ben White also started the game, so it had that feel of players trying to impress upon the manager Gareth Southgate that they should be included in his squad for the World Cup later on this year. Southgate saying himself, though, that he wants all of their matches in 2022 to be like competitive games for that World Cup. Is that the best way to prepare, I guess, is my first question, because I saw that and I thought, should you bill it as something so serious so early in the year? What do you think, Tony?
No, it shouldn't be that serious. I mean, look, it's a lot more importance on players that are given the opportunity to play. And within that, you've got different formation you had in the first half to the second half, personnel that hadn't played together. So it was quite a complex sort of scenario for England and Gareth. Do you really need to be that brilliant sort of 6 months before a tournament? No, you need to have ideas about who you see, what they're capable of, not only in the match, but in the training preparation before the game. So don't take it too seriously. Who's going to think about Switzerland at Wembley 6 months down the line? Honestly, nobody. They're not going to think about that result. What they showed, Switzerland are a decent team. You know, we saw that. We see them that in their qualifying campaign. They've been a decent side for probably 3 or 4 years now. And I think that was the challenge for Gareth, to get a team, to get a result. And not necessarily deserved it. I thought they showed some good things, especially early on in the game, but not very well structured. I think the three at the back didn't really work. He changed it around. I thought Conor Gallagher in the first half showed signs of what he's capable of. But honestly, the result is not that much of an importance. With performance and everything around that, I wouldn't be too concerned about.
It's interesting, though, because Gareth Southgate actually stressed the importance of the result, given their performance wasn't that fluid. It was almost like, well, it was a bit like a competition in that, you know, we didn't play that well, but we got it done. We won the game in the end. We fought it out. And I thought this window was going to be all about young players sort of, you know, impressing on the manager that they should be included in his thoughts going forward. How do you see it, Tom Roddy? Is it more about just casting an eye over new talent, or is there a big pressure on the manager to start showing that they're going to be winning games?
A bit of both, really. And I think on the competitive game side, I think his point is more, if you're going to play an international friendly, then play against a side like Switzerland, who are, I think, 14th in the world, can cause problems at both ends of the field. That's the main point, really. So you're not, it's not a day out that's going to bore people, you hope, even if it did for some. And and it's going to prepare you in the long run. The thing is, you've got to... A semi-final of the World Cup 4 years ago, the final of the Euros, whatever's happening, whatever's happened before in the preparations before has been working. So there's no need to change things drastically. One thing as well is, I think he's at 100 players now that he's used since he became England manager. And it was interesting because after the game, he said, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. So your point about casting an eye over new talent, different talent, and we sort of get the likes of Conor Gallagher coming in now and thinking, well, could he? Is it too late to make the World Cup? And maybe it is a little bit like that. That you're getting to a period where you're not sure. It maybe needs to be slightly more settled at this point.
I'm not sure about it, but I do think Switzerland and Ivory Coast coming up next, they almost, you know, it almost feels like the two warm-up games before a tournament, doesn't it? Because you've got that juxtaposition of location and styles as well. And I'm sure we'll talk about the game against Ivory Coast. But Tom Clark, on the sort of younger players in the squad, I think we should focus in on them. Mark Gahey, Conor Gallagher, Ben White as well. Let's talk about Gahey first, though. The Crystal Palace centre-back making his debut. I think he did offer something different, in particular with his feet.
Yeah, and I think we discussed it on the preview show, didn't we? Talking about how if there was a big match coming up tomorrow, Gareth Southgate, like lots of the positions in the team, which is why this conversation about who impresses is quite difficult, because ultimately England have a very strong squad and strong starting 11. But we talked about the idea that if you're going to not pick Harry Maguire, you might as well pick someone with different attributes. And as you say, Gabe showed that. And I think of the three, he was probably the brightest in the sense of a long-term sense. Because that's the other thing about players, you know, playing for England at the minute and getting their first starts. There's a sense of, well, are you going to be a potential starter in the next 5 years, at the next Euros, at the World Cup in... two sessions time. And I think for him, in that respect, that's one of the more bright sparks, because, say, to contrast Conor Gallagher, I think he did okay, but I think some of the players he's got in front of him, you know, Declan Rice is going to be an England central midfielder for the next 8-10 years, Jude Bellingham as well, you would have thought. So for him it's slightly different, whereas for Gahey, you're looking at that centre-back position and going, there's an opportunity here, not just because of Harry Maguire's poor form, but because Maguire and Stones are a little bit older. So I think, yeah, he was probably the brightest of those three that you mentioned for me.
What do you think, Tony?
Let's look at Gahey as a player. He reminds me a lot of Sol Campbell. Obviously, he can recover with his pace. He's very comfortable on the ball. You don't need... Especially in international football, you're not going to come up against too many centre forwards that are dominant in the air. So now he's very comfortable coming up against a one that probably won't be a giant 6 foot two, I know, or 6 foot three forward, because it doesn't happen that often. There are international players who tick that box, but I think he's shown already from his Palace performances, and even when I saw him at Swansea. Now, Chelsea had a big asset in Gahey as a player, and they prepared to let him go. Now, I think he'll be one of them they'll regret further down the line, saying that, you know, yes, he's gone to Palace and we agreed a fee. I think he'll shine. I think he's very, very composed as well, which is a big plus. If you're composed as a player and you get the time, is which you will get, because England will dominate the ball more often than not against most international teams. Not all of them, but most of them. So him on the ball being better than Harry Maguire, which I think he's already, we already know that he's far more comfortable with having it, moving it, keeping it, not taking too many risks. I think it's a big thumbs up for him. So, long-term, I do think he'll make a big impact with England for Gareth.
I wanted to talk about someone else that played in central defence, Ben White. For a long time, I don't know, it's felt like he was building towards becoming an England regular. You know, he had great plaudits at Brighton. He gets the £50 million move to Arsenal. Arsenal are playing well at the moment. He's in the starting team. You know, you mentioned Harry Maguire. His form's going off a cliff, and you think, God, there's a spot there in central defence for England. If someone just grasps it, could Ben White be that player? And he didn't grasp it, I don't think, this in this game in particular. What did you make of his performance, Tom?
I think what he did possibly grasp is the 10th in line for right back, actually, because he probably had a better second half when they moved the formation to 4-3-3 and he was in right back. I mean, I don't know, Hugh, I was looking forward to Mark Gerhey's performance more. I felt like he is possibly a more natural long-term successor to Maguire, or even replacement for Maguire. I think he's just that slightly more assured. I think Ben White's very good on the ball. I think he had a good start. His distribution from the back, but I just, under pressure, I'm still not convinced by him. One point do have to make with all of this, and you obviously have to take your opportunities, but you have to give Ben White a little bit of slack, and you also have to credit Mark Gerhey even more, because they're playing in it's back three, but a total of a back five defenders, four of which don't really play for England ever. You know, Luke Shaw is the regular, the rest aren't. So they're coming into a side that don't play regularly together at all. A lot of pressure on an opportunity in a World Cup year. So that has to be taken into context as well.
Yeah, I think the marking for the goal was pretty bad.
It was, yeah.
And it is a question mark, I think, of Ben White, that he's not necessarily the leader in a defensive line. I think Gabriel for Arsenal's taken the plaudits in that regard. And of course, people do question his size for a centre-back. I don't think he's small, Ben White, at all.
No.
I think he could have dealt with that situation had his marking been better. I don't think that was a factor.
Hugh, on that, you have to really think about this sometimes with footballers. If someone makes a mistake, and he clearly did for the goal, he gets caught, you know, and Mbolo gets half a yard on him, sneaks in behind him, and he gets caught flat-footed slightly, and his ball's in behind him before he knows it's in the back of the net. But I think the one thing I would say is that you've got to be very careful if someone makes a mistake and then that's not good enough. You know, I think if you're a continual, error-based centre-half, like a goalkeeper, if you continue to make mistakes and people say, look, you can't keep doing this. I've seen him a lot at Arsenal this year and he's made very few mistakes. Mm.
What I was going to say about him is, and this was my overarching point, I think that those, and there are very few of them, but those mistakes or those moments that he seems a bit shaky, because at times you feel like the word erratic could be used about Ben White. It's not, maybe that's a bit strong, but certainly not as calm or assured as someone like Gerhey. Is that had he been playing in the Europa League this year, and I think he might be playing in the Champions League next year, I think that will help him massively. I know that people say the Premier League is this, that and the other, but it is a particular type of football which I think he can deal with in the Premier League, and I think he's one of those players who will learn very quickly. And Mbolo is someone who plays in the Champions League, gone up against the best defenders in the world, and I think playing against the best forwards in the world, and I know again some of those are in the Premier League, but that difference of style will help him massively. So I think he will take a leap before the World Cup if they reach the Champions League.
I was at the playoff final when Brentford played Swansea, and Gerhey had a real runaround by Ivan Toney. I mean, he literally, 6'3", dominated him in every area. Now, going back to what I said, I don't think that's as important in international football, because you don't get too many types of Ivan Toney sort of structure, you know, or stature. Because that ultimately, I came back that down for all. But then you have to think, well, when you go to the Premier League, you know, you have certain players that are going to be a threat physically, but not that many. Chris Wood, for example, might do better against Gaye than another type of striker. He's probably more comfortable up against someone where he can dominate, because I see him do it a lot for Palace this year.
Who would you have preferred play against, Gerhey or White?
I've always said I played against Tony Adams, Martin Keown, David O'Leary, Steve Bould and Andy Linegan. Who did I hate playing against? Andy Linegan. I never got a kick. And I can give you another one I played against, and I've done okay against him a few times and quite enjoyed it, was Sol Campbell. Now, Sol Campbell didn't have to play up against someone as big as me very often, and Sol was a fantastic athlete and a hell of a player. But I actually, if you said to me, who would I rather play against, I would name a lot more. I would have said Tony Adams, Martin Keown, and a good few others. Andy Linegan, I remember being in the dressing room, he's in the lineup. Oh no. Linegan. I played against him at Oldham, never got a kick. Played against him at Norwich, never got a kick. Then he was at Arsenal, and I dreaded him being in the lineup.
What was the difference?
Andy Linegan was very much, even probably an inch bigger than me, very quick for someone of 6'4", and just a straight up and downer. And that, and you know, there are players that hate playing against a certain type that you just don't like playing against them. And they don't have to be, you know, they could be a far lesser player. You know, Andy Lindegan wasn't nowhere near as good as Keown, O'Leary, Adams. But against me, I hated it. Mm. So you do have that in football sometimes. And you said, mentioned Ben White and there and Gaye as two centre-halves. But if you had said to me someone of, maybe Harry Maguire, you know, I would have probably gone, well, Harry, 6'5" and quite dominant. I probably wouldn't have enjoyed that so much. So sometimes styles play a part.
Let's talk about the midfield. I'm delighted by this. Over the last sort of 18 months, 2 years, you know, being in our age group, Tony, you know, we very much grew in the years of Lampard, Scholes and Gerrard, and the arguments over who should be in central midfield for England, and choice between, you know, three of the great central midfield players of English football. You know, that was the great pub argument for many a year, and we haven't had that in the central midfield area. But I feel like the emergence of Jude Bellingham, yeah, Conor Gallagher, who played at the weekend, Declan Rice, who's going to go on to even greater things soon, and we might have a truly elite central midfield area.
Calvin Phillips.
I mean, there are others. Yeah, there are absolutely others. But those, the improvements of Rice plus the emergence of the other two, I think could be huge for England. So Conor Gallagher, Tony, I'll start with you on this. What does he offer an England side that maybe the other, and that, you know, there's James Ward-Prowse who can play in there. Yeah. We've got Mason Mount already. Phil Foden could play in the central midfield area. So could Jack Grealish. We've got Jordan Henderson, who started at the weekend as well. He's towards the tail end of his England career, but still more to offer. Yeah. What does Conor Gallagher offer this squad that maybe the others don't?
Well, you've already alluded to it. Something different. And it's a goal-scoring midfielder. Now, if you look at the Premier League, the top goal-scoring midfielder at the moment is Kevin De Bruyne, who plays in many different positions. But there hasn't been a goal scorer, in my opinion. I think Conor is capable of getting 15 Premier League goals a season regularly. Now, you can play a two. You could play, like you said, Bellingham or Phillips and Rice in a two, whatever ones you want to select, and have him just behind Harry Kane, because he is fantastic at arriving, like Lampard. He's got same traits as Lampard. Arriving late, and sometimes Harry drops deep, he runs beyond, and he does that brilliantly as well. So I think he offers something different if Gareth feels he has to change the formation, because Conor Gallagher is the only one I'd want to go to offer a threat from midfield, as in goals. And I think that, for me, is a big standout feature of his game. He probably won't start, because I don't think Gareth will go that way in games. But if there's ever a reason for Gareth to go, right, let's change our formation, the game's not going how we want it to, let's put Gallagher in there in front of the two midfielders who are very good at winning the ball and keeping the ball, but have someone have the freedom to make runs. Mm. Conor Gallagher is your man.
He can also, I think, turn a game that you're not excelling in for England, because he can win the ball high up the field. He's very much a disruptor. You know, he can be an annoyance. And the thing that Gareth Southgate pointed out after the game was he doesn't just win it and give it. Once he wins it back, he gives it and he goes.
Yeah.
And he's trying to put pressure. You know, he understands that the defence might be scrambling, and he's trying to find a gap. He's trying to pick a hole. He's trying to make that forward burst.
Well, he's got two challenges, Hugh. One of them's to get in, if he goes back to Chelsea, is Thomas Tuchel going to use him? Because he's got to get in the first team at Chelsea to have a chance of going to the World Cup. And obviously, if they send him out on loan again, which is still another possibility, but he's got two obstacles. If he's going to get in the England squad, is one of them getting back to Chelsea and being a regular. And the second problem is, if he doesn't go to Chelsea, where does he go next season? Will it be Palace again? And get goals? Because I think Gareth, but select him, is already thinking of something different in his squad. And he gives that.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom?
He's the complete midfielder, really, in terms of both sides of the game. I mean, Tony was just talking about his attacking qualities. And when he was on loan at Swansea, in 2019-20. They used to have at the training ground, just by the boot room, they had on the wall this list of who'd run the furthest, who'd run the fastest in training that week. And every single week, pretty much, Conor Gallagher was at the top because he just runs and runs and runs and covers so much ground. And that doesn't make you the best footballer in the world at all. No, it just doesn't. But at Chelsea, they already sort of see him as similar traits to N'Golo Kanté. And, I mean, you can't go too far wrong when people are comparing you to him.
Mo Salah does that as well, Tom, doesn't he? Mm. You know, like, continually just runs and runs and runs, and he keeps getting chances. Every time I watch Salah, I think, how does he get so many chances?
Well, it's the work rate, isn't it?
It's his work rate and continual running.
Yeah, absolutely. Big future for Conor Gallagher. Going to be interesting to see how much he's used in an England shirt, because I think, again, if you give him that responsibility, if you bring him off the bench, four games in the Nations League in the summer as well, they're going to be important and competitive, if you like. As long as he stays fit, I think he's got a very, very good chance. And I should have mentioned, by the way, if those of us that watch the under-21s take on Andorra, and yes, it's Andorra, but Jacob Ramsey is coming as well. And
yes,
to keep an eye on him, the Aston Villa midfielder, of course, who's made a great, great start under Steven Gerrard and under Dean Smith as well. Look, up next for England, it's Ivory Coast, as I mentioned. Elsewhere in terms of the home nation, so it could have been a huge game this week for Wales. Instead, they're going to have to wait until the summer to find out if they're going to make it to Qatar. Gareth Bale scoring two beautiful goals to send them into a World Cup playoff final in June, where they'll play either Scotland or Ukraine. Remember, that tie, of course, has been delayed until June. In a way, that's great for Wales because Aaron Ramsey and Gareth Bale don't have to have those two high-pressure games, high-energy games in the space of 5 days. They can now wait and prepare, and hopefully they're both fit for that game, in terms of Wales' hopes, of course, at the end of the season. But let's talk about Gareth Bale in particular. A lot of people having the argument after that match, and I think it's only right that we mention it. Is he the... I'm not going to say the greatest British player ever, but of the past 40 years... Is Gareth Bale the best British player we've seen?
No, in my opinion.
Who is it?
Well, I'm biased. I'd have Kenny Dalglish, most definitely, in front of... And a good few others. I would say Gareth is the greatest export from this country to go abroad and achieve what he did. I think it's been exceptional. I mean, you don't go to... How many players can you think of have lasted 9 years? And his career has been... incredible at Madrid, as in 9 years, six of them were fantastic. The last three haven't been good. You know, and it's just not this season for Gareth. I think he's got five for Wales this season and one for Real Madrid. And yes, he was on loan at Spurs last year and got a number of goals. But in some ways, a little bit disappointing because we saw how good Gareth could be, a little bit like he was for Wales. He's been dreadful for 3 years at Madrid. And then I say that because people will say how much he's won. He did. He won a lot and was fantastic for six. And most definitely the best player from Britain to ever go abroad. You know, and that in itself is an amazing feat. But to put him on the, you know, the sort of top of the greatest British players ever, no, I think there's a good few that I could name off the top of my head that I would certainly, from Liverpool, Arsenal to Chelsea players and Manchester United's teams who have been successful under Fergie, I'd put them ahead of Gareth.
Tom Clark, is that harsh?
Oh, it's so difficult with Gareth Bale because when you watch him, I was watching those goals and also so many of his goals in his career, he plays a bit like a computer game player on FIFA. You know, that free kick is like one of those ones where you put the little arrow in the top corner on the old PlayStation games and you tap the button precisely at the exact moment and it goes exactly in the top corner. And the same with the second goal, that kind of spin and flick straight into the top corner. He's a fantastic and remarkable player to watch in lots of ways. And as Tony says, because of these last few years at Madrid, you end up having a overarching debate about his status when he's such a gifted and brilliant player to watch. I must confess, I do slightly disagree with Tony and find myself going back to those early years, back to his goal-scoring record. I mean, even with the last couple of seasons, his record at Madrid overall, 81 in 175 games, that's still incredibly good. Yes, that's based on the earlier years, but, you know, he's got four Champions League winner medals, two La Ligas. It's a pretty extraordinary career. I agree with Tony that I don't think he's one of the British greats, but I'd actually put him a little bit higher. I'd say he's definitely up there. not just for what he's done for Real Madrid, but also, I mean, Tony, you tell us, there's a flip to saying, oh, he's not been able to get fit, he's not been able to get into the Madrid team. Is there not a, you know, flip argument to say, well, actually, at the top level, to not have game time and then step up for Wales in a massive game like this and play and then score, that's pretty impressive. That shows a unique and remarkable talent, doesn't it? We all talk about, oh, you've got to be fit, you've got to be match fit, and actually he doesn't play for Madrid and then turns it on like that. That's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is, and the type of goals he gets is extraordinary, Tom. And look, I'm not trying to be clever here and say, you know, of course his legacy in football is going to be extraordinary. Especially the Champions League winners. I mean, look, Real Madrid win the Champions League quite often in comparison with most teams, don't they? You know, so they're a side that are continually being successful over the history of the game. And he has played a massive part. If you'd have said to me when he first signed, what was it, 2013 Madrid, that he would still be there in 22... I'd have said, well, that's never going to happen. You know, what export has ever done that at a football club abroad? I thought I'd done amazing the last 6 years in France. I mean, he's surpassed and by a country mile. You know, whatever I achieved by staying there, longevity in a foreign country is a really big thing. Not many do. He's done that. I'm always, maybe I'm wrong, Tom, on this, because I've always thought, there's more in Gareth Bale. And even with what he's achieved, I still think there was more. And sometimes I look at him and think, I don't think Gareth loves the game as much as he should do. And I think that's been evident over the last 3 years. He loves playing for Wales, but not much else.
But isn't it fitness?
Isn't it? Of course he's been injured.
Held him back.
Yeah, well, it has held him back. I mean, I mean, he's... Sometimes, Hugh, he's had a twisted sock and you feel like he's not going to play. You know, again, maybe I'm being really harsh because I just think he's always put himself available for Wales and he's left Madrid being injured and come over and then played for Wales. And, you know, look, we're pretty... sometimes we get a bit fickle in football. And imagine if Gareth Bale was playing for Man United, right? And he never was available, or especially in the last 3 years, hadn't turned up a lot. And then suddenly went to Wales, where everyone be going, oh, every time he goes to Wales, he's brilliant. And he comes back to us and he's not playing any part. And that's how Madrid fans are feeling with him. You know, it's not they're just against him. They think, well, he keeps doing this when he goes away with Wales. And when he comes back to us, he's not available. And when he is, he seems a little bit disinterested. Is that unfair?
I think Tony is onto something there a little bit, because what he benefits from this side is that generally fans in the UK don't watch Real Madrid week in, week out. So they see the highlights, they see the great moments. If you ask Tottenham fans from the loan last year, how did he get on?
Mixed,
exactly. And what they would probably say is, well, he's a legend of the club. You know, it's that historical context they would bring into it, because it was slightly underwhelming. There weren't, it wasn't the consistency that they may have hoped for. But, I actually thought that moment, it summed up his career with Wales. And it's a little bit like the Beckham Greece free kick. Just amazing quality.
Tottenham weren't in a big rush to take him back, were they?
No. And I think Gareth Bale is up there in terms of individual quality British players. So the longevity argument is, I guess, an aspect to it. You could bring in trophies if you like, individual awards too. But I think on his day, fit and firing, virtually unplayable. You're going to tell me Kenny Dalglish was the same.
Well, no, I'm going to tell you there's many players on their day that were impossible to play against, because on your day is your very best, and Gareth Bale's very best is an extraordinary level.
All right, I'll take it on the chin from Tony Cascarino, a bit like Chris Rock. Listen, let's talk a little bit about what Gareth Bale had to say after that game, because I think it was quite important and maybe plays to the twisted sock narrative, Tony. Gareth Bale hitting out at Spanish newspaper Marca for what he called slanderous, derogatory and speculative journalism after he was called a parasite in the build-up to the game. And after the great performance, Bale took to social media, describing the Spanish press's reporting of him as disgusting. He said, At a time where people are taking their own lives because of the callousness and relentlessness of the media, I want to know who's holding these journalists and the news outlets that allow them to write articles like this accountable. He then went on to say, the media expects superhuman performances from professional athletes, and they will be the first to celebrate with them when they deliver, yet instead of commiserating with them when they show an ounce of human error, they are torn to shreds instead, encouraging anger and disappointment in their fans. Tom Clark, what did you think about what Gareth Bale had to say about journalism in particular?
Yes, the evil media at it again. I sympathise slightly with what he says, because in his case particularly, he has had some very pointed treatment, should we say. But I always do have as I would, because I'm completely biased in my job, I do have an issue with the branding of the media, as if we are some kind of outer, otherworldly organisation. You know, we're not. The media in various different strands is a business. And a lot of the time, particularly newspapers, but also viewers, it is reflective of society and what viewers, readers want to read and watch. And so there's a difficult balancing act to be struck between just pointing the finger at the media, because you shouldn't just point the finger at the media. It's about a bigger question than that. But I have to acknowledge that sometimes the media do go too far, and that I think in Gareth Bale's case, that is absolutely right. I mean, the marker situation is particularly striking, and I think for him personally, he's obviously had a very difficult time. But that's what I mean. I guess it's not just the media in Spain, is it? This is a particular incident, but it's reflective of Madrid fans who've been particularly harsh at times, and how he is viewed in, you know, Spanish society, if you like. And so that's my point, is that I'm always then wary of the pointing of the, oh, it's the media, the evil media, when it's about something far bigger than that. And the way in which we brand, as you know, Bale has had certain things attached to him, that is also reflective of society in whole as well, and that we're not particularly great these days at not having incredibly impassioned and sometimes incredibly insulting opinions about people. And that's where I would say that he's right to raise the point about how we discuss people, how we point the finger, but it's not just the media's fault, I would say.
Yeah, it's quite easy. Just point out the journalists who wrote that article and point out the newspaper that writ it or had wrote that article and was okay to accept it, because the words parasite is way too far. There's a line in the sand on lots of things. But if you're going to take it to a level of, you know, scum sort of journalism, in my opinion, I mean, I joked about saying a twisted sock, you know, I mean, but that's not calling him a parasite. We've just talked about Ben White and his performance and what he failed to do for the goal that England conceded at the weekend. We have our right to talk about incidents of players. I never had a problem. I know I had some stick, by the way, as a player during my career. I never had a problem with it, as long as they didn't get personal and go too far. With that, you can only prove people wrong by crossing the white line and what you do on the pitch. Now, if someone goes personal on you, go for them. That was always my... I would say, if I played badly and you give me a bad rating and you said I didn't do this or that in the game, I had no problem with. And I'd never argued against that, because that was an opinion. If it went too far, I would let someone know that I read it and I didn't like it and wouldn't let them get away with it. That's different. And I think you can do that to the media sometimes. You can point out the person that wrote the article, of how bad that journalist is.
I know, but do you know what happens now? Because there are so many opinions on the internet that if Gareth Bale was to say this journalist was wrong, that journalist then gets all the abuse that Gareth Bale is saying he's found difficult to cope with, or other people have found difficult to cope with. And there might be, I know it sounds weird, but he might be saying, look, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy in many ways. So if someone does write something negative about me, I would rather encourage positive journalism.
But that's not negative, Hugh, is it?
No, he knows what his fans, and there are many of them, will say about a journalist who said something that he's not happy with.
Consider that when you write the article. When you're going to use the words parasite,
yeah,
consider what...
It was a cartoon, basically, where they mocked him up as a mosquito and called him a parasite.
But, you know, the bigger picture for Gareth, he came... You know, for me, it's influenced a lot of people to think like that. And he's not a parasite. Mm. And yes, his career in the last 3 years that I touched on has been on the downside to regards to Real Madrid. But there's a fine line. You know, you can't just aim... I mean, severe criticism, vulgar criticism yeah. at someone. That's way too far.
Journalist Tom Roddy?
No, Tony's...
he's nervous. It's clearing his throat. Yeah. What have you written, Tom?
No. I'll back you, Tom. I'll back you, Tom. Don't worry about it.
Don't publish it, Tom. Don't publish it. I agree with Tony. And I also think that... a lot of, you know, we actually see in Spain a lot of it does go over the top, and you compared it, Tony, to what we were talking about before with all the comparison and the contrast between Ben White. We were analysing his performance. This piece, if you actually read it, it goes even further than Parasite, and it's about his personality. It's about his traits as a human being that he's calling into question, not whether he's prolific enough or clinical enough. One point I kind of would make and. Is that this has been building for quite a while, hasn't it? And I think possibly on Gareth Bale's side, and I think it's really important, is communication, because the thing he was accused of for so many years, he's been there a long, long time, and I believe he has learnt Spanish over the years and understands it. But he doesn't communicate with them too much and hasn't done down the years. And I think that's a massive thing. I'd compare it a little bit with the Mesut Ozil situation that he had at Arsenal. And he was receiving so much criticism, deservedly so, because you had different managers who lost their patience with him. But I remember him doing an interview, I think it was 2019 possibly, reading the interview and understanding his side a little bit more. Mm. So... maybe that would help a little bit.
Can I just say one thing on this? You know, we talk about how bad it's been. Now, everybody was celebrating Gareth Bale in the UK about his brilliant two goals. What do you think the reaction is going to be in Madrid when he gets back? More anger, I would imagine.
Yeah.
More anger, because yeah, yeah. he's done that for Wales.
Yeah.
And he's coming back to us, but he's not going to do it for us.
Yeah. Well, they'll just see it as backing up yeah. the Wales goal for Madrid, won't they?
Yeah.
Given that it's International Week and we've seen the home nations in action, of course, you're a former Republic of Ireland international, so this might not affect you, but I am interested on your view on it nonetheless, Tony. Matthew Syed, not too long ago, writing in the Times that he believes a UK football team should exist and that individual home nations should be scrapped. This has caused, as you can imagine, some uproar. He says, "Am I alone in regretting that history was not different, in wishing that football in this nation had started out much in the same way as the Olympics, in wishing that we could have drawn on all the talents of all our countrymen, that football was a source of shared pride rather than often bitter division?" And I need to play you this because I asked Jonathan Northcroft on the last podcast what his views were. Have a listen.
I hope he's alone. Oh my word. Please, 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 you know, expunge this idea. First of all, you have to believe in the UK. I'm going to put my cards on the table. And I believe in Scottish independence. So of course I'm not going to say, let's have a UK team. I don't necessarily believe there should be a UK anymore. But leaving that aside, you know, leaving politics aside, the nations are so rich for having their own teams. Football has got a different history to Olympic individual sport, as does rugby, older histories. And Scotland, England's the first international. This is embedded in the history of the game worldwide. Four British, GB, UK nations or whatever, being founder members of FIFA, all that sort of stuff. It's just horrific. And I think basically just to give England Andy Robertson, use of Andy Robertson, you know, you sort of get these arguments from time to time from people down here, but there's nobody in Scotland to go for this.
And I tend to agree with Jonathan, I have to say, that it would be a bit of a disaster, but I do think we are missing an opportunity, which is why I wanted to put it to you three. I honestly believe that in the spirit of the Olympic Games, when in women's football we do send a Team GB to play in the football competition, that we should be sending a Team GB to play in the men's football competition. This is, bear in mind, these shores are the home of football, but that we should give these opportunities, I think, to a squad of players who we believe are unlikely to experience anything like it. So why not send a team of under-23s from the Football League or from non-league football? We've got a magic non-league pyramid, if you like, in England and the other countries as well. Even if it was just a team of players from the League of Wales and from outside the Scottish Premiership and teams in Northern Ireland and non-league in England, give them the opportunity of going and playing in front of that big crowd and maybe, you know, who knows, winning an Olympic medal when they're unlikely to win anything of major note elsewhere in their careers. I don't see why that would be such a bad thing, Tony.
Well, you're diluting it completely there, Hugh.
Why?
Well, yeah, if you were sending in 11 that were Premier League based or just generally the best players in Scotland, Wales and England.
Northern Ireland.
Northern Ireland as well. Mm-hmm. Well, the only player I can think on, and Jonathan touched on it, is going to be Andy Robertson that gets in the team. Otherwise, it's an England team. It's not a UK team. It's an England team plus one. And, you know, and that will be the generally the case for beyond.
Well, you could
unless
say...
Unless you dilute it, you suggested.
You could say, right, OK, everyone's got eight players, you know, or if you like. So England, you call up eight. Scotland calls up eight. Wales calls up to eight. And Northern Ireland calls up eight. And you give it to the responsibilities to those football federations to call up their eight players.
Bad idea. I can't think of any other words, Hugh, but it's a bad idea. You want to dilute it to try and make it work.
Well,
we don't have a
team at the moment, so we're not diluting it. I just want there to be a side.
Well, you would be diluting it.
I mean, I'm giving us a side where there is no side at the moment.
Well, I can't think of any other words, but a bad idea for
Tom,
me.
The prospect of it feels like just an experiment to an extent, which I'd be fascinated to see, but doesn't mean I want to see it. It doesn't mean it'll work. It's one of those things where you go back over recent history and you think it would have been interesting to see what would have happened if Gareth Bale in his prime had been playing with all these players. Ryan Giggs, and that was partly where it comes from. You know, Ryan Giggs was always the solution to England's left side problem. But that's it. That kind of sums it up because it's the England team plus one, as Tony said. It's almost patronising to the other countries, and it will, as one subscriber to the Times commented, it will unify all the other nations in deciding. Like Tony said, it is a bad idea.
Can I just say something, Hugh? If you look at rugby and at the Six Nations, and this was also common in football. Everybody loved playing England. Like, Scotland loved playing England because they wanted to beat them badly because they didn't like the English. And that was across the case. That's the case for Wales, Northern Ireland, and certainly Republic of Ireland. Obviously, Republic aren't in this discussion. But generally, England were always looked down upon as in, we want to get one over England. You know, and that's the case. And I don't see that, like, uniting, having a UK team. I don't think it's the same in football like it is in rugby.
You're missing, and this is where football's exceptionalism sometimes. You know, are you telling me that people in North Ireland don't cheer on Team GB in other sports at the Olympic Games? Are you telling me that...
Not in football, Hugh.
Listen, are you telling me that Scottish people do not cheer on Team GB at the Olympic Games? Why suddenly, if they put a football at their feet instead of running spikes on a track, do we suddenly hate the idea of people from Scotland and Wales representing Team GB? I don't get it.
Football's very tribal. Yeah, remember that. Mm. You know, having a running track and a Team GB is totally different from having the world of football where tribalism is everywhere within football and the hatred and toxicity in football is extraordinary. So I think it's a really bad idea that...
I mean, I've tried to be fair. Maybe. I've given everyone the same number of players and you still hate my idea. Tom Clark, final word from you.
It's a tricky one. Matthew comes up with lots of interesting ways of looking at sport. This is one that I don't agree with him on. But also, there's an interesting conversation to be had. Tom alluded it to it there. I think part of what Matthew was talking about was the idea of not having individual nations and having this kind of super team. You know, he referenced the Ryan Giggs situation. He referenced the idea, as Tom said, of having Gareth Bale. But that enters a myriad of problems, and people like Johnny Northcroft would never allow it to happen. I think your idea, Hugh, is a better one, but still, from a sports fan who absolutely loves the Olympics and a sports editor who absolutely loves the Olympics because it's the 2 weeks of the year that you don't talk about football, the last thing we need is a football team being part of it. And I agree with Tony's argument towards you that if you're going to do it, you might as well do it properly and don't kind of dilute it with players from lower down the pyramid. Having said that, we ran a reader poll on the website with this piece, and I was fully expecting it to be, you know, 94% no, it's terrible. 57% of times readers think it's a good idea. So what the hell do we know?
And how many times did Johnny press no, I wonder?
that's the big question.
Listen, it's not going to happen, but it was worth the conversation nonetheless. Plenty still to come on the Game Podcast. But remember, if you're enjoying yourself, rate us, leave us a review, and make sure you're subscribed.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, as will probably become regular over the next few months, let's get an update on the bidding process for the new owners of Chelsea. We know what's happened. Roman Abramovich, their former owner, if you like, has been sanctioned by the UK government. The club is up for sale. There were names flying about in the media. There were so many rich people saying they wanted to buy Chelsea. And now we have a shortlist, and it was decided at the end of last week. So let's speak to our sports correspondent, Matt Lawton, who joins us now. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Hugh.
Where do we stand on who is buying Chelsea right now, and who are the remaining names?
So we've got four that we know about, because the Rain Group, which is this merchant bank that is leading this process for Roman Abramovich, they don't actually, you know, they haven't issued a statement where they've said these are the people on the shortlist. But the four that we know about are the Todd Boehly Group, the guy that co-owns the LA Dodgers, and he has Jonathan Goldstein, the British property investor, and a Swiss billionaire, Hans-Jürgen Wyss, on his consortium, part of his consortium, and backed by Daniel Finkelstein, who is a Times columnist. Then we have the Martin Broughton Group. So Martin Broughton Group, I'm pretty certain now that they are indeed backed by the two guys that have invested in Crystal Palace, Josh Harris and David Blitzer. And they are supported by Lord Coe, Seb Coe, World Athletics president, big Chelsea fan. Then we have the one I know least about, the Boston Celtics owner, Stephen Pagliuca. He is apparently on the shortlist. And finally, we have the Ricketts family, the owners of the Chicago Cubs. They're backed by a guy called Ken Griffin, who is the single most wealthy, the wealthiest person, I should phrase that better, the wealthiest person involved in this whole process, worth more than $20 billion. So he's worth almost double what Roman Abramovich is worth. He's a rather rich man. I was actually talking to an MP last week who said to me, "You haven't met a billionaire?" And I said, "Yeah, I've met a couple." She said, "They're very different. They're very different people." I said, "Yeah, they inhabit a world that none of us can comprehend in any way." and the one I've met is Jim Ratcliffe. And yeah, it's very weird meeting a man who's worth £22 billion. Is it? Yeah. Why do you even bother getting out of bed in the morning?
Matt, I was going to ask you, Matt, on that, You know, a month or so ago, we was all led to believe that Chelsea were going to be on the be a steal, go on the cheaper, maybe a billion less than their valuation of Roman Abramovich. But that's clearly not the case now. It's actually going to go to the bidders, where we're going to go, Chelsea are going to probably even get a premium on the club.
Yeah, it's interesting, Tony, because it was. I remember I've just mentioned Jim Ratcliffe, and I had this bizarre exchange with him a couple of years ago when he bought Team Sky, the cycling team, and they became Team Ineos. And I'd done a story a few years ago where I'd written that he had had a tour of Chelsea's training ground. And it was quite interesting because initially Chelsea denied it. Then we went back and said, no, I'm telling you, this is right. We know it's right. And then the club sort of reconsidered their position and confirmed that, yes, he had had a tour of Chelsea's training ground. I then asked Jim Ratcliffe this at the launch of Team Ineos, and he denied it. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. This was during a press conference. I went up to him afterwards and I said, you've just denied that you had a tour of the training ground. Sorry, this is a very long-winded way of answering the question. He said, you just denied that you had a tour of the training ground. I know you had a tour of the training ground because the club confirmed you had a tour of the training ground. And he said, yeah, I was never going to admit that in a press conference. So anyway, but the point is about him. He balked at buying Chelsea when I think what he offered was in the region of 2 billion. And the reason he balked at that was because you spend your 2 billion. Bearing in mind, I don't think any sports franchise has gone for more than 3 billion. He balked at that because you buy it for 2 billion and then you've got to spend at least 1 billion on the stadium. So it suddenly becomes very expensive. So I was talking to one of the key figures on one of the four groups last Friday. And I actually said, are you not all overpaying for this? Because I said, well, what do you think it's going to go for in the end? And they said, I think between 2.5 and 2.75 billion. I said, well, aren't you overpaying? Bearing in mind that you've then got to spend another billion on the stadium, because it's a massive expense, the stadium. Like, we all thought it was bonkers spending 757 million on Wembley, but the complication with Stamford Bridge is you've got a cemetery, you've got the tube station. It's a civil engineering nightmare. So it's incredibly expensive. But their view was that if you maintain the success of the team, if they remain a Champions League force, if they continue to contest the Premier League title every season, their view was that once you have spent that money on the stadium, the club will be worth 5, 6, 7 billion. So they see it as a good investment. Now, they recognise that once you get in there, you've got to look at the business plan properly, because the guy I spoke to estimated that when you look at it, when you delve into the data, when you look at the books, Abramovich has been propping it up the whole time, the last 19 years. So whatever's going in and out with sale of players and revenue, TV revenue, that every year on average, he's had to pump in another 75 million to keep the thing afloat. So in terms of running it as a business, it's got to be run more efficiently. But their view is, sorry, it's such a long answer, Tony, but their view is that basically it is valued at the right level.
There's a part of me that thinks that's almost worried at the number of people involved in property who had an interest of buying Chelsea. And that maybe one day soon, the new owners might think of relocating Stamford Bridge. In fact, that piece of property, and I know they don't own the pitch itself.
Well, as I was about to say, they can't do it, Hugh, because it's quite clever what Bates did, or Ken Bates did, when he created the pitch owners, because he knew that Ken Bates has had a lot of criticism over the years, but the one thing he was smart enough to realise was that the wrong owner, who doesn't love Chelsea through and through, might think, as we all know, right, you know, look, it's the best piece of real estate in football, isn't it? It's slap bang in the middle of, you know, Fulham, Chelsea. It's an amazing piece of land. And he realised that an unscrupulous owner could just go, right, well, I'm going to cash in on this. and I'm going to move them to wherever, you know, to you know, the out, you know, out near the M25. So it's actually in the legal contract that they can't, if you were to move it, you wouldn't be able to call them Chelsea Football Club.
And whenever billions of pounds come into things, I start thinking there's a workaround, to be perfectly honest with you, Matt.
The Kings Road Lakers.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I mean. Yeah, right. Well, fine. We'll move the club, but we won't call them Chelsea. We'll call them the Chelsea Football Club or something like that.
And well, yeah, it obviously happened with Wimbledon, didn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what he's trying to guard. That's what Bates was trying to guard against when he basically handed the ownership of the 125 yards by 75 yards or whatever it is to the fans.
One final question, Matt. When do we see a resolution to all of this? When will Chelsea have new owners? And of course, the legal stuff with the UK government, how will it work now? Do we have a clearer picture on where the finances will go?
Yeah. So the letter they all got, the four groups got at the end of last week, did say that they hope to have everything done by the end of April. And they know that there is pressure because the club has only got so much money in the bank, because Abramovich's assets have been frozen, they don't suddenly have access to his riches. So that's what they said. Now, obviously, they also said that, you know, in the next couple of weeks, they'll then be looking to, people have speculated April the 11th. I think it said in the next couple of weeks, they will look to receive the sort of final proposals. At the same time, the four bidders get the chance to come in. We wrote about this on Saturday morning in the Times, that the four bidders get to come in. They get to meet Thomas Tuchel. And as one of the bid groups said to me, you know, they actually want to sit down with Thomas Tuchel and basically say, are you sticking around? They need to get a sense that he's committed and that he's going to be comfortable with a change of ownership, and he's not going to go, as has been speculated, to Manchester United or somewhere else. So they want to speak to him. They want to sit down with Gravelskaya. That still remains a very interesting dynamic, you know, given that she's only ever worked for Abramovich throughout her entire career. But yet she is the sort of the transfer business guru. So there's a process of where the bidders get to look properly at the club, but at the same time they continue to look at the bidders. Once they do arrive at that decision, and it's Marina Gravelskaya, Eugene Tenenbaum, director, and Buck with the Rain Group, Bruce Buck, the chairman with the Rain Group, who will make a decision on who the preferred bidder is, then that bidder will be presented to the Treasury, because ultimately the Treasury has got to approve the sale. So you've got four at the moment. That will become one, I assume, by mid-April, and then they try and get the deal done. And if the government give the green light and they go, you know, let's say for argument's sake, it is the Bowley Group, and they go, yeah, they've got the funds, we're happy with it, they meet all the owners and directors test. Obviously the Premier League, you've got to be part of this process as well. Yeah, we're happy with Todd Bowley. Yeah, we're happy with Hans Jorgvis. Yeah, we're happy with Jonathan Goldstein. Yeah, they can be the new owners of the club. And then I think after that, as Richard Masters, the Premier League chief executive, said a few weeks ago, it can then be done in about 10 days.
Okay, Matt, thank you very much for the update. We will try and keep all of the Chelsea fans posted on that one. Appreciate it. Now, very quickly, before we go on the game podcast, still time to react to Italy. And Italy in particular, going out of the World Cup. The second World Cup in a row they will miss. They are, of course, the European champions, no less, beating England in a final at Wembley. Roberto Mancini is their manager, and there are reports in the country this morning that he will stay in charge of Italy. He has signed a contract, the former Inter Manchester City boss, until the 2026 World Cup. That's not news. He did that a while ago. But there is some insecurity, some fragility, of course, if you're the Italy boss and you don't reach a World Cup. So my question really is, should Manchester United or Newcastle United be interested in poaching Mancini this week? Be cutthroat. Go for it. Try and steal him out of the job when he's at his weakest. Tom Roddy, what do you think?
Hugh, what are you doing? You're poking. You're just poking your fellow Man United fans, aren't you? This isn't... That would not go down well, surely.
Why?
Why? Because of his history, that's why.
As a winner, yeah, maybe. I mean, we hate winners, don't we, at Man United?
But you say that, but he did a fantastic job at City. Probably an underappreciated job now because of Guardiola coming in and this era of dominance. So it's slightly underappreciated now. But, you know, what we have learned over the last few years at Man United is that the guy who stands in the dugout isn't the person whose sole responsibility to solve all these issues. He's not the big problem, is he? We know that now over the years. So why bring in someone who's going to be divisive from the start? Newcastle is a more interesting point, but not now, no. Eddie Howe is the right man for the football side right now.
I mean, I'm not sure about either of those. And it was put to me that I wasn't a proper Manchester United fan for tweeting that Manchester United should go for Roberto Mancini as soon as Italy had lost that game to North Macedonia. And that's a great story in itself. But
maybe you could do a poll.
Listen, they told me I'm not a proper Manchester United fan. And I said, look, if it was Guardiola in 10 years' time, are you telling me that you wouldn't want him to manage Manchester United? And some Manchester United fans said, no, never, because he's coached Manchester City. And I said, well, what about Jurgen Klopp? Are you telling me that you wouldn't want Jurgen Klopp one day to coach Manchester United if he one day leaves Liverpool? And they said, no, absolutely not. Because of a loyalty to Manchester United, they said. And I said, I'm loyal to Manchester United. I want them to win. I want them to have the best players. I want them to have the best manager. And that is loyalty to me. Maybe I'm just a different type of football fan. And I thought that was harsh. So am I wrong to say that, Tony?
Well, this comes from a conversation with Jack Charlton, Republic of Ireland, when he became a manager after coaching at Sheffield Wednesday, Newcastle. And he said to me, one day in your career, it becomes quite evident you're a better international manager and what you like about football and what you can give to football is suited to being an international manager. And I think there's very few examples of managers that go to international football, then go back and are successful. I think they get caught in the world of football is a daily thing, 24 hours every day. Now, that doesn't mean that international football is not demanding. I just think that Mancini now is at the place best suited for him to be successful as an international manager. Going back to club football, I think, is a very difficult thing to do. You're talking about Guardiola and Klopp and, you know, would you like... Of course you would like a manager of that calibre. But I do think the next move, if you said Guardiola, will be the international football and not club football.
I get what you're saying, Tony, but let's think about this. Sit in the hot seat of Manchester United's chief executive here. You're talking to Erik ten Hag. You're talking to Mauricio Pochettino.
Yeah.
It might be Luis Enrique. It might be Julian Lopetegui. Isn't Mancini a better manager than all of them?
No, I think he's best suited now to international football.
Oh, okay.
And that's where he's doing his best job, unless they had success last summer. I just think sometimes football will go past you. It evolves, and for you as a coach or a manager, there is a time when you have to go, this is now the best place for me to be is international football and not back to a club.
I don't know. On the basis of his past affiliation with Manchester City, then would that rule him out? Say he'd never coached Italy and he'd never been in international football. Would you say still it would be impossible for him to coach Manchester United?
I don't like that idea at this stage of his career. He's been around a long time and coached at different levels and for a lot of different clubs. So I think he's now where he should be. And go. You try and give me an example of someone.
I'm going to give you an example.
Who?
Do you remember a certain Sir Matt Busby, ex-Manchester City and Liverpool player, who went to Manchester United and, as far as I know, did quite well and is a bit of a legend in those parts. That's all I'm going to say. All right. Yeah. So if you're going to bring glory
to
the club.
Back to 1966.
Listen, yes. You're going to bring.
Can you get a little bit closer to where we are now?
If you are going to bring glory to a football club and it works. Listen, if Rafa Benitez won every single game and got Everton to the Champions League, they wouldn't care that he used to manage Liverpool. Had he brought them that great success, we know how it went. But had it gone very differently, it would have all been forgotten. It's all about winning games. As far as football fans are concerned, you bring them what they want and they will adore you. Obviously, the initial part is going to be very difficult, but you can win them over, a bit like you were talking about Gareth Bale a little bit earlier on.
Does he fit into the category that they're looking at the moment, which Pochettino, Ten Hag, Lopetegui?
No, he's better. He's a better coach. He's a better coach. He has won 3 league titles in Italy. He's won 4 Coppa Italias. He's won a Premier League title. He has just won the European Championship with Italy. He is a level above the coaches that they are about to appoint.
Go back to Jose then. No answer here.
I mean, Jose.
If you want to list what he's done,
but they went to Jose. But let's be clear.
That was very strange. There was a silence.
Tony's almost backed me up there, though, because you've backed me up because Jose Mourinho was an arch rival while he was at Chelsea of Manchester United, and they still appointed him. Why? Because he's a winner. The fans, by the way, hated him, and you all know I didn't want him to be Manchester United's manager when he was appointed, and I never thought it would work. Had he won the league, had he won the Champions League, this would be a Jose Mourinho Stan account.
Well, he won 2 trophies.
I know, but he didn't win what Manchester United. Manchester United, there are levels, aren't there? Manchester, you don't take the Manchester United job to win a League Cup and win the Europa League. You want to win the FA Cup, you want to win the Champions League, you want to win the Premier League. But if he had, he'd still be there and he'd be a Man United legend. You know, had he brought the results, had he brought the success, all would have been forgotten. That is all I'm going to say. Tom Clark, what do you think?
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed all of that. And yeah, definitely going to do a reader poll on it just to see what the Times readers think. I started off thinking, same as Tom Roddy, you can't bring in Roberto Mancini. It's all about projection. It's all about the optics for Manchester United. And then actually, I'm starting to think that maybe it'd be the perfect thing to get an ex-Manchester City manager in, because it would finally kind of get rid of all the kind of, you know, furore around this is Manchester United, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, they're just a football team that need a good manager. End of discussion. So why not get him in? And then after he's had a few years clearing out the dead wood, get Steven Gerrard in afterwards. Happy days.
Or Benitez.
As long as they win, Tony. As long as they win. All right, that's the requisite. You need to win titles.
Or Mark Hughes, then. You've got both. Ex-Man City manager, legend of United, Bradford to Old Trafford.
This is what we're talking about. Listen, gentlemen, been a pleasure, as always, to be with you on the Game Podcast. Thank you, Tom Roddy, Tony Cascarino, and Tom Clark, and to all of you for listening as well. And remember, you can subscribe to the Game Podcast and to the Times and the Sunday Times as well. You can enjoy brighter insights on politics, business, and much more, including sport. For just £1, you'll get 3 months of everything. So you can subscribe at thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you on Thursday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.